Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order this morning. It's Friday, February 6th. We've made it through the first week, committee. Appreciate your attention on some issues today. We have four bills to hear about today. We're going to start out with House Bill 2548 on the schedule. So that's the second one down on the list. And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2548.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure permits the playing of social games, and poker tournaments in certain establishments if they're authorized by a city or county. It establishes the standard for determining the dominant use or the purpose of the establishment that's conducting the games, and allows the operator of the poker game or the tournament to employ persons to manage and operate the games or the tournaments, and to impose fees on players and to recover a percentage of the operating expenses. You have before you a dash one amendment that came from the sponsor of the bill that makes, although it is a replacement to the original bill, it really makes a few technical clarifying corrections that are noted on the staff measure summary.
Great. So Representative Greenlick is here, and is Representative Parrish coming up with you?
No.
She's on the other side of the...
A couple of wingmen with me, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me?
I had a couple of wingmen with me.
Yes. Anybody you wish to bring up? I don't have the sign-up sheet in front of me, do I? I do now.
Jeff Sugarman and John Ohi.
So John Ohi and Jeff Sugarman is, I assume, who you wanted with you?
Thank you very much, sir. Yes.
So good morning, and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning to you all. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, which is Northwest Portland and way out into Washington County. And I'm delighted to be here today to introduce you to House Bill 2548. And I appreciate you holding this hearing. It's been more than 40 years since the legislature first provided the opportunity for cities and counties to regulate social gaming. There was a lot of confusion back in those days, and the legislature first in 71 and 73 took up the issue, and we've been operating on the statutes since that time. You may have noticed a change in the world in the last 40 years around gambling. We have casinos, we have slots, we have all sorts of changes. The cities, excuse me, have been having problems determining exactly what the circumstances should be for regulating the social gaming clubs, and many of them have emerged under a sort of haphazard regulatory environment. This bill, which we've worked with the city, at least the city of Portland, has asked us to be involved. We've been working with them. We worked it over two sessions now, and we think it's ready for prime time. Its main purpose is to continue to allow cities to decide whether or not they want to have these kinds of social gambling institutions in their environment. It gives them the full authority to decide, but if they decide it's appropriate for their community, it gives them a clear set of regulations, a clear set of understandings, a clean set of sideboards to that regulation, and we hope you'll take it under serious consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Does anybody want to ask a question of Representative Greenlick before we hear his other testifiers? Seeing none.
I actually have a feeling that the other testifiers might have more information.
They actually know something.
Thank you. Go ahead. Whoever wants to go first, introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yeah. dear members of the committee, my name is John Ogai, and I'm the owner of Encore Poker Club, located on the edge of the Pearl District in Portland, Oregon. Encore opened doors in October of 2010, and our business model is very simple. We are a bar restaurant that attracts customers through offering daily poker tournaments. Encore employs 6 bartenders, 3 cooks, administrative assistant, and 5 shift managers who run our poker tournaments. I act as an owner and general manager at the same time. We open 7 days a week and run 6 daily poker tournaments. We are one of the many small businesses in the city of Portland that are embedded in the city's economic fabric and social ecosystem and deliver value by providing employment, having trade relationships with many vendors and suppliers, and paying our fair share of taxes, all along providing enjoyable and safe entertainment for many Oregonians to spend their leisure time. When I started Encore Club and received a social gaming license to operate from the city of Portland, I believed that I was building and operating a business within an established legal framework with clear rules and regulations. Within 1 year of being in business, it became clear that we have a viable business model that brings value to the city, the people, and the community. But the legal framework that regulates us was established back in the 70s and needs updating to reflect modern realities and allow us to run our businesses without the fear of being punished by outdated rules that lost their relevance. So I represent one of the many Oregon poker clubs that are really looking forward to the improvements and positive changes that this bill is going to bring to our communities and to our businesses. We as entrepreneurs poured our hearts and souls into our businesses, tirelessly built them for years, and all we ask for is to fix outdated legal framework that threatens good, robust working businesses that bring enjoyment to our customers and value to the city. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Sugarman. I am a lobbyist for the Encore Poker Club. I'm also a player at the Encore Poker Club, and that's how I met John several years ago. In 2013, there was a bill before the legislature that would have effectively closed the poker clubs down. The legislature at that time decided not to pass that bill, and we are back today to see if we can try and clarify some of the rules that the clubs operate under. The story of this bill actually begins back in 1971 when the legislature banned the playing of card games in private businesses and bars and restaurants and local venues. They came back in 1973 and changed their mind. And quoting from a DOJ opinion issued in 2010, representatives of hotel, restaurant, and bar workers unions, as well as representatives of private clubs, asked the legislature to amend the gambling laws to allow the social games again in business establishments. They informed the legislature that card rooms had been shut down due to the 1971 legislation, and those closures had caused unemployment among waitresses, bartenders, card room attendants, and workers who made the food and beverages sold in the card rooms. The legislature agreed. It retained the social gaming language and the definition of player, amended the gambling laws to exclude social games from the definition of gambling, and provided definitions of several that would allow the clubs to operate. And so since for the last 40 years, cities and counties, if they choose to do so, have been able to issue social gaming licenses to clubs like John's. Today, there are about two or three dozen of these clubs operating around the state, but they find themselves in a very similar legal situation as they did back in 1973. For while Oregon has simply changed, we now have casinos and a state-run lottery, including video poker in bars and restaurants. We have off-track betting. We have online gambling. And the statutes simply have not kept up. House Bill 2548 seeks to address three issues. The first issue arises out of a Supreme Court case, Ecumenical Ministries versus the state of the Oregon State Lottery, and it was around the video poker games that were established in about, I believe, 1984. In that Supreme Court case, the court ruled that the dominant use or purpose of a facility must not be for gambling, or it would be considered a casino, and the Constitution states that the state may not authorize casinos. What we do in the bill, but the Supreme Court at that time did also did not define what dominant use or purpose is. So the first section of the bill, section 2 of 2548, the -1 amendment, sets up a series of factors that cities and counties and the courts could look at in determining the dominant use or purpose of the facility. It includes factors such as the amount of square footage that's devoted to the gaming, offering other goods and services, the length of time that the facility has been in business, and what share of their operating expenses come from the operation of the game. Since the court did not define dominant use and purpose, it is well within the legislature's purview to do that. So that's issue one. The second issue is that because of these outdated statutes and a DOJ opinion from 2010, the statute says employees are not allowed to be employed as regular employees of the clubs. So right now, today, the dealers, and not the tournament directors and other people who help the tournaments, but strictly the dealers, are not allowed to be regular employees of the clubs. They are either volunteers or independent contractors, or they are members of a state chartered nonprofit member benefit organization, and really they exist solely on the tips of the players and the people who are in those clubs. We think that's not right. We want to fix that. We want them to be regular employees of the clubs, and so House Bill 2548 expressly authorizes the hiring of all people necessary to run the operation of the game. The third issue that we seek to address is how do the clubs recover their operating expenses. We modeled this section after the same statutes that operate under bingo halls. So bingo halls are part of the social the exception to gambling in these statutes, and those bingo halls are allowed to recover up to 18% from the player's prize pool to cover their operating expenses. We use the same format here for poker tournaments, where the players would all pool their money and make that part of the prize pool that they play for, and the club would be able to recover up to 18% of that player's prize pool for the payment of operating expenses, particularly their employees. In addition, there are often live cash games, or what are called in Portland tournament shootouts, which are largely cash games that are timed at 2 hours. So at the end of 2 hours, you have to cash out and buy in again. We allow the clubs to charge a seat fee for playing in those games. In addition, we include definitions for poker tournaments and poker games, what the operator of the establishment, and we try and basically define a situation where the clubs would be allowed to exist. In my mind, this is really more of a technical fix to these 1970 statutes than it is an issue about gambling. These card rooms have been around for decades, but today they face a threat to their operations, not because of their actions and not because of the game they offer, but due to a court case brought against the Oregon State Lottery. If we don't clarify the position of these clubs, lawsuits are likely to be filed. The city of Portland will not have the direction it needs to write new ordinances governing these clubs, and just as in 1973, people will lose their jobs and successful businesses could be shuttered. As a player, I find these clubs to be safe, fun, and challenging venues where I can compete against people from all walks of life. I've made good friends. I consider this form of entertainment one of my very favorite pastimes and activities. Since the early 70s, the state has allowed cities and counties to license social gaming activities in Oregon. This bill continues that tradition, but provides clear legislative direction on how the clubs can operate legally and safely. And it simply recognizes that the world has changed since the 1970s. We thank you very much for your consideration of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, if I may. One, both relating to the dominant purpose. One is by way of background, and then the other is specific to the bill. By way of background, so since 1973, I guess 1993, 94, Ecumenical Ministries.
That's correct.
Case,
I think I misspoke.
I can't remember. It's been a while since this committee has addressed these issues. I'm jogging my memory. That's where the dominant purpose criterion kind of appears. We've never articulated in statute, to my knowledge. Has there been any subsequent case law to clarify what dominant purpose might mean for local jurisdictions or for business owners?
Chair Hovey, Representative Barton, not to my knowledge, the only example of dominant use and purpose I can find is in the Emo versus Oregon State Lottery. I will do some research on that and see if I can find anything, but I've not been able to find any legislative history around that either.
A follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up.
So specific to this bill, one of the, I guess, purposes of this bill is to then clarify, and you choose a square footage approach, which seems, it's a reasonable way of doing it, but why that one as opposed to others? It seems to me like there might be some weaknesses. Let's pretend there were a bowling alley, right? That's a lot of square footage. But what if there were, say, two card tables with a very high stakes poker tournament with, say, $1 million on that, right? What's under this approach? I don't know, square footage doesn't quite capture value.
Chair Hovey, Vice Chair Barton, we actually set up a series of factors that the cities or counties can use to determine dominant use or purpose. Square footage is one of them. On page 2 of the bill, you can see under Big B, line 3, it also asks whether the establishment offers other goods and services and provides other types of games that the players can play. For example, I often play at a club down in Albany, which offers weekly cribbage tournaments and ping pong tournaments, and there's always a chess game going on. So there's always other kinds of social activities going on at the club. So that's another one of the factors that we use. Are you offering other games for players to enjoy? Another factor is, are you offering other goods and services, such as, you know, a restaurant and bar? So are you doing other things besides just the poker that are allowing you to continue to operate? We also have a time factor, how long you've been in business, and we chose 12 months. It's certainly something that we could look at to show that that's been a successful business operating without the poker gaming and continues to exist. And then the final factor we use on line 13 and page 2D is the total amount of operating expenses and how much of that is due to the operation of the game versus the operation of their other businesses. And so we set up a situation where cities and counties and even the courts, should it come to the courts, can look at any of these factors in determining dominant use and purpose.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one basic question I have right now, have these businesses been operating illegally then at this point?
Chair Holby, Representative Widener, we don't think so. The statute clearly gives cities and counties the opportunity to issue gaming licenses for these businesses. As time has elapsed, there have been issues raised about stemming from the Emo court case and the DOJ opinion of 2010. But at this point, nobody has attempted to shut the clubs down, and we continue to believe that they are operating within the statute.
I may follow up.
Follow up.
Are the cities and counties supportive of this bill?
Chair Holby, Representative Widener, the city of Portland has been the one that's been most active in asking for some direction from the legislature. We have met with the city of Portland. Part of the Dash 1 amendments include some of the changes that they would like to see in the bill. I think they are going to continue to be very willing to work with us on that issue. Other cities and counties have not expressed the same concerns, and still with this bill today, under current statute and with this bill, every city and county would still retain the ability to not issue these licenses should they choose to do so.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, one more.
I guess my next concern is, because we have video poker and everything, I just worry that we're opening Pandora's box a little bit with this legislation, because Oregonians have said overwhelmingly, we don't want casinos all over, and we've regulated it, we've allowed the tribes to do it. Can we be blowing the lid off or doing something that the citizens of Oregon do not want to happen by moving this legislation? So, because they've said overwhelmingly that we don't want Oregon to be like Nevada.
Chair Holby, Representative Widener, we don't believe these are casinos. There are no video poker machines in there. There are no slot machines. There are no table games like blackjack. There are no opportunities in these clubs where the house or the establishment itself is a player in the game, or where players are playing against the house, where the house wins because the player loses. In my mind, there's really two kinds of gambling. One is the wagering on sporting events and things like that where you have absolutely no control over the outcome. The other would be situations, as I just described, where you're in where you're playing against the house and the house has odds. In other words, over time, the house is always going to beat you, and the house wins when you lose. That, to me, is what constitutes a casino, because I've never been in a casino that doesn't have slot machines and blackjack, but I have been in many casinos that don't offer poker games. So I think there's a big difference between the two of those, and part of what we're doing here is trying to define these clubs as something other than casinos so that we don't run afoul of the Constitution.
Representative Fagan.
Thank you very much. So I, in the interest of full disclosure, have played at the Encore Poker Club and Aces on Southeast Powell back when I had free time before having a two-year-old, and definitely enjoyed my time. In terms of, I actually have a couple of kind of nitpicky statutory questions. So first of all, I'm kind of piggybacking on Representative Barton's questions about kind of the dominant purpose language. So the factors that you say are, you know, the city or county shall use one or more of these factors. And then one of them, section two. Okay. So the square footage or the portion of the establishment in which only poker games are conducted. And then, let me get my thoughts straight. Sorry, I'm looking at this on the... Okay, so you say that the dominant purpose cannot be for gambling. And then when you go to define that, they say you look at the square footage that's used for poker games versus the overall establishment. But poker games are not the only form of gambling. So, for example, in Encore, which is a nice facility, you know, there's a lot of poker tables, and then there's video lottery. So there's not video lottery in there?
Video lottery, no.
Is there not games in there?
No video lottery in Encore.
Okay, I thought I recall there being video lottery in there.
Chair Holvey, Representative Fagan, there are some of those small types of games where you might put a quarter in there, but there's okay. No money involved at all, and there's no...
So Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So is that a prohibition? Can there not be video poker in the same facility as these social gamings?
There wasn't really a prohibition, but when we applied for a license from the video lottery, we got denied.
Okay.
Follow up.
So that being my point then, so I apologize for being incorrect about Encore. It's been, like I said, it's been a few years since I've been there. But again, when you're looking at the dominant purpose could not be gambling, but one of the factors is only square footage versus social games, that doesn't also capture other forms of gambling that may be going on. Does that make sense?
Chair Holvey, Representative Fagan, I know of no clubs in that offer these games that are allowed to have video poker machines in there. And in terms of other kinds of gambling, I'm not aware of any in which the club is actually sponsoring that activity. So if there's another form of gambling you're referring to, I'm not exactly sure what that would be.
Like video poker. Yeah, so there's none that have video poker.
None that I am aware of.
Thank you, Representative Kinnemer.
Same video poker in some places where they play.
Representative Kinnemer's speaking now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard from someone in Boley that apparently there are some instances where, in violation of the law, people are allegedly being paid wages. And I wondered if you know of instances, and what is the penalty if they engage in this kind of conduct, which is prohibited to the dealers?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Kinnemer, I am not aware of any instances in which the clubs are paying dealers regular wages.
It's under the table. This is the allegation.
And I hope Vice Chair Kenemer that what we're doing with this bill here will clarify that the club should be hiring these dealers and all people who are involved in the operation of the game as regular employees. And as far as penalties go, I'm not aware of exactly the penalties, but I think this is the right step in moving towards allowing those dealers to be full employees and ensuring that the clubs fully comply with state law, sir.
Other questions?
Real quickly.
Representative Fagan.
So back to the dominant purpose issue. And again, I've actually gone to Encore, it's just hard for me, and I understand that you're putting down factors. It's just hard for me to imagine that the dominant purpose of going to the Encore Poker Club is not to play poker. It's called the Encore Poker Club. It's called Aces Poker Club. And so I understand that you're trying to put down factors to get around a constitutional issue, but just in practicality, I mean, are people actually just going there to hang out and not play poker? And it just seems a little bit of kind of a ruse to me. In the second one, the operating expenses, I know that Encore has food and drinks, and so that seems like kind of just an automatic checkbox, because obviously it doesn't cost a lot to operate, you know, pre-existing poker tables, whereas as long as you have food and drinks, clearly the operating expenses of having alcohol and food is just kind of de facto going to be more than operating tables that just sit there. So it just feels like a little bit we're trying to look like there's factors, but really it's kind of an automatic get around. If as long as you have food and drink, there's really, I don't see how you could possibly not have more operating expenses for food and drink than for poker tables. So I appreciate what you're trying to do just from the dominant purpose issue. It's just hard for me to imagine if the dominant purpose of these places is not social gaming, it just seems kind of de facto it is social gaming. And I appreciate the ability to put factors in, but those seem like a bit of a go around.
Chair Hulvey, Representative Fagan, we would be willing to consider other types of factors and would work with anybody involved to determine another set of factors. The Supreme Court case said that the dominant use and purpose can't be for gambling, and if it is, then you're a casino. I think there's, as we talked about earlier, the issue of gambling is one that is difficult to assess when you're dealing with poker. You're playing against other players. You're competing as much as you are. You're competing against other players, and so what we're trying to do is really find a way to both deal with the dominant use and purpose and clarify that the clubs are accepted from the gambling. So we're going to continue to work, and we're more than happy to continue to work on those factors.
Thanks.
Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff, I guess my question would be, because I actually play Texas Hold'em and stuff as well, and we usually go out to one of the casinos, and I haven't went to Aces or Encore or any of those just because in my mind it was illegal to go there and gamble where I knew it was legal to go to the casino. And I'm just wondering, when we have casinos already where you can go play cards, why do we need to expand it and open it up more when we have legal entities where you can do it in the state already?
Chair Holby, Representative Widener, first, again, we have between 24 and 35, 36 clubs that have been operating around the state for quite some time. So I don't think that we're looking at expanding gambling. This is actually something that's occurring already under statute, we can argue whether it's legal or not, but it's actually happening out there right now, and it needs some regulation and it needs some direction. It may be partly due to that these clubs have come into existence, you know, partly because of the explosion in popularity since 2003 when Chris Moneymaker won the World Series of Poker, and it has just
off luck.
Boomed. Excuse me?
Off luck, not good play.
But as in any competition or sporting event, there are elements of luck involved. That's the way the ball bounces. At the Super Bowl a couple of weeks ago, there was a catch by a receiver where the ball was kicked and bounced around. That was pretty lucky. It didn't end up giving the Super Bowl title to the Seahawks, but that's the way the ball bounces in athletic events. So I think partly the reason people, at least from my personal experience, from where I live, it takes me over an hour to get to a casino, but I can get to one of the poker clubs in a very short period of time. And so I think there's an ease of, a proximity issue here too. But frankly too, I enjoy the atmosphere at these small clubs. I tend to see the same people week after week, and we become friends, and it's a great social environment. I think my favorite couple at the Albany Poker Club, where I often play, is an 85-year-old couple named Ken and Ann, and you know, they come once or twice a week. They love the game. They love the social interaction. It's very affordable for them, and it's a great outlet for them to be able to enjoy life in their later years.
Mr. Chairman, I have a final statement. Mm-hmm. I think the situation is trying to deal with the relationship between reality and theory. And in this case, we have a reality that these clubs have emerged because people want to get together and play poker, and play poker in a safe environment. That's the de facto side of this. And the de jure side is things are really confused, and the cities aren't really knowing what to do. So it seems to me the reason I've been supporting this, and I have never been in a club, although I like playing poker occasionally, I think this gives the cities and the counties and the local establishment and the local authorities some clear-cut definitions about how to deal with the problem, how to deal with the situation that they see emerging in front of them. It seems to me the intention is not to create more clubs, not to create more gambling, not to deal with any of the problems that I think video poker, particularly video line games, cause, which make me very nervous. This is a much safer form of entertainment and social interaction, and I think providing clarity is a valuable thing to do, and that's essentially why I've been supporting this bill. And thank you very much for hearing us, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick. Seeing other questions at the moment, I have one question, I guess, that, absent the city of Portland or any of the other cities in this regard, I think the current statute gives cities and counties the authority to authorize these social games and create ordinances and regulation for those licenses. And so, you know, to me, we've given that authority to a local community to decide what's right for their community. And so now we're, so I'm just kind of wondering, outside of these issues, why can't the cities do this now?
Well, Mr. Chair,
and regulate that. I mean, what is the direction that we're supposed to be giving them that they can't do by themselves right now?
Right now, they're facing uncertainty because of the Supreme Court decisions. All this does, it doesn't take away their ability to write ordinances or to not write ordinances, if that's their preference. What it does is give them clear legal standing for what it is they're trying to do. So the reason we've been working with them is because they really don't seem sure what to do right now. And all we're doing here is sort of clarifying that situation as they decide whether or not to write ordinances around this issue.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Chair Holvey, it is very true that the cities and counties feel like there's ambiguity out there right now. The statutes tell them one thing. A Supreme Court case seems to tell them another thing. There's a DOJ opinion of 2010 based on the email case that again puts into question or places these clubs in what I would consider a relatively gray area. And so I think it is most appropriate for the legislature to put the broad sideboards in place while still allowing the cities and counties the full opportunity to decide whether or not they want to authorize the games in their communities, and if they do choose to do so, they certainly can write local ordinances. It's one of the things that the city of Portland asked for was some direction as they look at rewriting their social gaming ordinances over the next couple of years.
Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Weider.
I guess I'm just thinking and looking at this because I love the aspect of local control, letting cities and counties do what they want to do. But one of the things I think we're missing here is I don't know if they have the resources to actually regulate this and monitor it, so I wonder if we shouldn't be looking at a funding mechanism so they can employ people to actually monitor what's happening in the facilities and everything. So say there's a house, you go to the casino, and this is one of the reasons I don't like going to the casinos is they take a pretty big rake, but they got a big establishment to take care of. If there shouldn't be some sort of rake set up off of every pot, I mean, if we're looking at this and going to do it right, to where there's money going into the city so they can actually have the police patrol and monitor or have an enforcement officer to regulate the way that it should be regulated. Have you thought of that at all?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, I know all of these clubs are required to get business licenses in their cities and counties, and oftentimes that comes with a fee that I think could be used to pay for enforcement. In my experience, there's really not a lot of enforcement activity from the law enforcement standpoint that occurs at the clubs. In my 4 years of playing in these clubs, I've never seen any kind of incident that would require law enforcement, though I'm quite sure that they have occurred in some cases. It's something I guess we would be willing to look at, and it's something that certainly cities and counties could adopt by themselves if they so chose to do so. And I think that's probably the place where it ought to be handled. That's one of those things I think cities and counties should be able to decide for themselves.
So, and I think Representative Widener brings up a good point, and I'm curious, does this bill establish a percentage that the establishment or how the establishment makes money off of these social games? Do they establish what their percentage of the game will be or what they charge people for playing in their facility?
Yes, sir, Chair Holvey. Similar to how bingo halls operate today, it allows the club to get charged up to 18% of the player's prize pool in a poker tournament for operating expenses, and it allows them to charge a seat fee for playing in what would be considered more of a live cash game. And one last thing, the bill specifically actually prohibits the taking of a rake or taking money from the outcome or the playing of any single hand. So thank you
for that clarification. I think we're going to move one more, Representative Fagan.
I appreciate you guys have been really good sports. I'm still a little stuck on the dominant purpose thing, and I know that you're pressured to define that because of a Supreme Court case, but to me, like, the real thing that you need to worry about is the definition of gambling, because really your premise is the idea that these social games are really not gambling, therefore, you know, square footage argument, etc. So I think that that's really where you're going to be primarily hung up a little bit, because it's just hard for me to say the dominant purpose of these is not to have these poker games. So if you're saying that's not gambling, that seems like an appropriate place to focus some energy as well.
Thank you. Do you want to comment real quick before?
Chair Holvey, Representative Fagan, we're happy to work with you on that issue. We feel like we have to, for constitutional reasons, we have to try and find a way through that. But we do also believe that these poker clubs, as we're defined in the statute in 2548, would be accepted or from the definition of gambling, too. So we're trying to accomplish both of those things. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. We're going to move on, so we do have a few more people to speak. Appreciate that, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, State Rep from House District 37, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill. In 2013, it was brought to my attention and to Speaker Kotek's attention that we do have a problem with these poker rooms. The current way they operate is that there is a cover charge to walk in the door. There is tipping that happens to the dealers. Dealers are not paid. They are scheduled like regular job shift, and apparently they can be fired, which is what I think Representative Kinnemer was talking about with the Boley issues. There are some pending investigations at Boley right now. You can reach out and talk to Commissioner Vakian about that. So it's kind of interesting to me that we don't employ people, but we fire them from these poker rooms, and then we don't pay them real wages. We pay them and rely on players' benevolence to be paid with tips. So there is certainly an employee wage and hour issue that is happening in these rooms. I think Rep. Fagan brought up a really great point around the dominant use. In every other state, dominant use is not declared by square footage. What my research has showed is that it's based on revenue. So your food and sale beverage revenue is one category of revenue. Revenue from the gaming is another category of revenue. Percentages are looked at then in terms of what is the dominant use, what is bringing in the revenue. It's not square footage based. I've got a craps table in my basement. I could, you know, probably consider that a very small space and run social gaming out of my basement under the way the current, you know, statutes look. And I'm not, you know, and I think the papers kind of unfairly painted the speaker and I as somehow being anti-gaming. I got married in Nevada twice to the same person, just for good measure, once in each city. So I wouldn't put myself in the anti-gaming category that way. I'm also not anti-business as a business owner, and I do play bingo. So interestingly, you heard Jeff Sugarman talk about the bingo halls in Oregon. Well, let me tell you about their purpose. Their purpose is not a for-profit entity. Every bingo hall in this state is regulated and licensed by the Department of Justice. You go in and they actually read you the rules from the Department of Justice every time that you play, and there's a very clear, here's what we're going to do, here's what we're not going to do, and here's what your rights are as a player, and that is declared every single game in every single hall in this state. They have a nonprofit mission. So the place where my sisters and I have always gone, which is actually because of the unfair competition that some of the poker rooms, they're actually closing their doors in the location they've been in for 30 years and moving into a smaller facility. But their purpose is to support sports in our state, and specifically sports that don't get a lot of funding. So they support the gymnastics, kids who are out doing gymnastics tournaments. They also support the Oregon Fencing Alliance, which would raise money to send Mariel Zagunas to the Olympics from Beaver. So a little bit different mission in terms of why people are there and the actual goal with the money. They are allowed a percentage of operating expense, which does go to cover wages that they are actually paying to their folks. There is tips that do get pooled, and they go out into the wage of everybody, and they're equally distributed. So a little bit different comparison, and I don't think that Mr. Sugarman was very clear, as they're trying to do something that is really apples to oranges in this case. And so, there's a Boys and Girls Club bingo here in Salem. There's a DAV for veterans up in Portland. But they all have a stated charitable mission. And what House Bill 3518 from the 2013 session tried to do was say, okay, if you're going to have poker rooms, then run them like you would the rest of our social games in this state. They did come and tweak these statutes in the 70s. And what happened is in the 73 session, they said, okay, we're going to test this out. We're going to open this up. They came back and called a special session in 74 to shut it down. And Representative Kinnemer can certainly, I think, talk to you a little bit about the gray rooms in Portland and why they came back and said unregulated for-profit gaming in this state was probably not a good idea then. And, you will hear, interestingly, last bill, when we brought this in, it came before the Rules Committee, not a single owner testified. It's pretty clear they were operating out of compliance, and I believe that, I've talked to a couple of owners in some other spaces, different outside of the city of Portland, who's like, we're not coming to testify in that because this is so clear, we don't want to be on the record of actually, potentially incriminating ourselves talking about what we're doing in our business model. I have talked to dealers from different poker establishments, and so I think if we're going to clarify, let's find a way to clarify it. But I think Oregon voters were pretty clear in that, they don't want for-profit gaming, and they voted that just recently in two election cycles ago. I understand that poker is, kind of an interesting game. I've played poker. I'm not a very good poker player. Much like I said, I prefer to play a good game of craps. But at the end of the day, the current model is not working. And in terms of what the city of Portland, I have talked to Charlie Hales about this. I have talked to the to the DA's office about this. It is really an issue of enforcement right now, why they aren't going in and actually trying to regulate these. And I think, you know, I'm talking to the gal who issues the licenses for social gaming in the city of Portland. I mean, the conversation I had with her was basically, you know, we thought we were doing one thing and issuing the license, and we had no idea it was going to turn into this. And they don't know how to put that genie back in the bottle. I mean, I think there is a need for some clarity, and I don't think this bill does that.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Not seeing any questions. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Up next, I have David Ellsburn, I think, and Wes Wood.
Chair, may I just say real fast, I did submit two documents to you, the 2010 Department of Justice opinion, so that you all have that as well. Mr. Sugarman referenced that. But I also wanted to share with you from the Tribal Gaming Alliance, they've got a little fact sheet about gambling. You know, there is kind of this notion that, well, it's tribal games on our Oregon casinos that are run on tribal lands, and that tribal games are somehow, you know, those casinos somehow run unfettered and outside of the law, and they're their own sovereign territory. That is absolutely not the case. The tribal casinos in this state actually pay OSP to come in and regulate them, and their books are also open. So in the case of the bingo situation, DOJ can come in and open up their books anytime, and if they're even off a quarter in their accounting, then they are heavily levied with fines. The same is true with the tribal gaming. OSP can come in there anytime and open their books, and what this House bill is saying is, let's just do that unfettered, and nobody has a right to come look at our books, and there's no accountability to the player. So I just want to add that to the
record. Thank you. We have that information up here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you. I guess I'd encourage members maybe to read the bill, too. I think there's one sentence that has me kind of concerned. I don't know that I can support it with a straight face. It says, gambling does not include poker.
Mm-hmm. Where is that?
I find that hard. I'm trying to find the I'm so looking again.
Well, let's go ahead and listen to the rest of the testimony now. So if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is David Ellsburn. I'm a president for Voices of Problem Gambling Recovery Incorporated, at least until next Monday when we hold our next elections. until then, I'll speak about this. We're a nonprofit organization based in Portland, Oregon, made up of persons in recovery from gambling problems, their family members, and others concerned about problem gambling. And I could go ahead and continue to read this whole letter here, which our organization has prepared. And it's much more eloquent than what I could say, and much more thorough to cover the reasons why this bill is not a good idea. But you all have a copy, so I'd like you to read it afterwards. Instead, I'm just going to speak about something that concerns me, but the technical details of this bill. And it's obviously that Representative Greenlick, you know, or whoever helped him prepare this bill spent a lot of time on it, and there's a lot of measures there to prevent poker dens and card rooms from getting out of hand. And so I commend him on that, but all these measures that are in the bill that could easily be circumvented. So I could give you examples of how I could circumvent them, but I don't think we need to do that. We could go back to 1973 when this has been, we've been there and done this before. And 73, the legislature was facing a similar bill, and the legislature was kind of reluctant to pass this bill, but the business people said, well, we'll agree to limit our profits to 25% on gaming, to 25% of our total profits. And so the legislature said, well, that should keep a lid on it, so let's do that. So then card rooms began proliferating, and right away they started cheating on not only the 25% provision of the bill, but other provisions of the bill. And after a while, the Attorney General got really frustrated because he found it very difficult to keep control of this because of the creative accounting practices that these businesses used. So in 74, the legislature said, well, we made a mistake, let's rescind this. So I don't think we should repeat history again. I think the bill is written. It's probably not a good idea that we should put it to sleep right now and not let it get out of committee. Thank you for letting me testify. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Go ahead, and we'll listen to the next testifier. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Holvey and committee. My name is Wes Wood. I'm currently Director of Public Relations Services for Voice of Problem Gambling Recovery. We are a 501c3. We've been serving the Oregon community for 7 years now. Personally, yesterday was my 10th anniversary of entering treatment. It's prepaid and it works. On behalf of the 82,000 people in Oregon that get up every morning and start their day by planning how they're going to gamble or raise the money to gamble, I want you to keep an open eye what the total economic picture means for Oregon. When those people plan their day, let it be known that their children and their families and their homes and their jobs come second to what they do in order to raise the money and have that event. There's much more time spent on the planning and on the chaos created than on the gambling. What I can tell you is, after my 2 years that I was blessed with in treatment, I have a better clarity around what all is involved in this than probably most people in the state. We spend a lot of our time as a speakers bureau. We educate through community forums. We talk to clinicians, care providers statewide. We work with peer mentor groups, and we work with legislators. So my sole purpose today is that you keep that task in mind, that those numbers are growing. They continue to grow. They provide the majority of the revenue, which the Oregon Lottery benefits from. I understand fully why the lottery exists and its partnership with the state. The types of things that I think most need to be stated are about youth programs. We know that there are probably over 4,000 adolescents in the state right now that are deeply into compulsive gambling problems. We know that it impacts high levels of bankruptcy and divorce, mental health and addiction problems. Suicide levels are higher with this than other addictions. Civil crimes, criminal justice systems are filling up with the residual problems from generating funds to gamble. Currently, we're serving between 1,400 and 2,000 people in treatment each year, be that residential programs or outpatient. We know that responsible play and responsible gaming is a key piece. We know that prevention and education is a key piece. We work very closely with the Oregon Lottery and the Problem Gambling Services Department within Oregon's mental health. I would ask that you ask the right questions about which parts of this legislation are important, whether it is just a housekeeping measure or whether it is a tool to expand for those that are waiting to grow the industry. It's very important. You know, and to put the burden, as you have already addressed, put that burden on the local municipalities for enforcement. I have great concern around that. You know, we know what it's like to try and regulate currently with the Oregon Lottery and the massive task they have to enforce the rules that we deal with. So that's really all I have to say about that. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to take them.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Congratulations on your continued recovery and everything over it. I know how difficult it is. It's something, as being a member here for a while, that we've got to deal with. Representative Kinnemer and I actually sat on a committee where we've seen the Oregon Lottery destroy life after life after life of people who've got addicted to this type of thing. And I just want to commend you for being here and advocating for people that are, I mean, suffering from gambling. And I've seen it affect a lot of different people. So I want to thank you for being here and sharing your story with us today. So I just wanted to thank him for being here today, Chair.
Thank you. We do appreciate your testimony, and certainly your perspective is something we all consider. So thank you for your testimony today. Representative Kinnemer.
Just, I guess going back to your testimony, access is one of the key issues for addiction, isn't it? That's just a comment, a question.
Yes. Is there a question in there?
Yes, that was supposed to be a question, poorly phrased. But okay. The issue of access is a key factor in addiction.
Well, what we've found for the treatment piece, we clearly the prevention and education piece is what sets Oregon to successful inclusion of the Oregon Lottery. What we know is that when we stub our toes, as we did a couple years ago, and DOJ made a ruling about Oregon Lottery's ability to participate in any advertising campaign that may include things such as treatment access and educational forums, we saw a travesty in the decline of folks that pursued treatment. And the reason for that is the perception with the loss of, for example, the television ads led people to believe that treatment had gone away. And that was criminal. You know, so that has since been turned around. We have a really robust relationship right now with the Oregon Lottery. We work very closely with them on development of, they have a new website out, which is Oregon Problem Gambling Resource. That website, as well as the numbers and crisis lines, we've also added chat rooms and very social media related processes for people to get help. You know, and it's a key piece for them to know there's help available. So I'm really happy to see that has greatly improved. And Representative Kinnemer, I appreciate your comments to that. We've spoken before about this, and it is a huge piece whenever we step away from showing that treatment is there. So I hope that answers your question.
I'd like to answer your question about access. I think that is a key point, because if you have a susceptibility to gambling addiction, but the nearest casino is an hour away, you're much less likely to fall into that. But here in this zip code, 97301, there's 37 places where you can go play slot machines. So they're pretty much everywhere. And it's also a big problem for someone who is in recovery, because they have to drive by these places every day, and they know where all these places are.
Thank you. I appreciate the conversation. Certainly we could talk, have a whole informational hearing and look at a lot of bills to deal with problem gambling and how do we deal with that. And I know this bill is about, poker rooms and social gaming and that sort of thing, but it doesn't really involve, how we're going to deal with problem gambling. So thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
I appreciate
it. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Up next, we have Carol. Cannot read the last name. Carol?
Hardy. Sorry.
Oh.
Hardy. Lousy handwriting.
Good morning. Good morning. And I know that problem gambling is a big issue for this state with the lottery and all sorts of things, but we're really trying to focus in on the aspects of this bill. So.
Yes. So I appreciate that. Good morning, Representative Colby, committee members. I do represent the Oregon Council on Problem Gambling. I am the chair. I also have a long history with gaming. I was the marketing director of the lottery since 1987. I have been gone for the last 3 years, so I have a perspective also of larger perspective than just what the council represents. However, the council comes forward today to say that we are in opposition of the bill the way that it is written. And there are really four reasons why we take that position. One, section...
And could you stop and just identify yourself for the record? As we were talking about your name, I don't know that you actually identified yourself, so...
Okay. I'm Carol Hardy. I am the chair of the Oregon Council on Problem Gambling. I've been the chair for 6 years. I've been involved with the council since 1995 as the marketing director of the Oregon Lottery, so I've been involved with the issues of problem gambling, responsible gambling on many sides. But the council does appreciate this opportunity to address this particular bill and how it's written. And our mission is to promote the health of Oregonians by supporting efforts to minimize gambling-related harm, and that's really the direction of our testimony. We don't have an opinion on the moralistic value of gambling. We have a neutral position on legal gambling. We do oppose the legislation, as I said, for three specific reasons. In Section 3 ORS 167.117, Item 7, it says it excludes poker games or poker tournaments from the definition of gambling. This is inconsistent with the common definition of gambling. Gambling is wagering of money or something of material value or an event on an uncertain outcome with the primary intent of winning additional money or material goods. It is council's position that that exclusion be removed from this bill. Within this bill, there's no exclusion of minors from engaging in gambling activities. And again, we do believe that poker is a, in its pure definition, gambling. Disordered gambling is a public health concern, and research demonstrates that early individuals engaging in gambling, the greater risk they have of developing problem gambling in the future. The state lottery, tribal casinos have taken a position to restrict minors from gambling, and it's the council's position that an age restriction to exclude individuals under the age of 18 from engaging in gambling activities be added to this bill. Additionally, enacting of this bill would expand gambling opportunities and subsequently increase the opportunity for more Oregonians to experience problem with gambling. The council's position is that operators be required to post readily accessible problem gambling prevention materials, including as a minimum the Problem Gambling Services Helpline. I will also state, even though it's not in this testimony, that being involved in gambling in Oregon for the last 30 years, the Oregon Lottery operates under extreme regulation. They are fair, honest, secure, integrity. That's what they are held to, those standards. They're held to it by the state police, by the commission. The tribes are held to those standards through their compacts. They have, as was mentioned, the state police provide oversight. And the bingo halls also, as Representative Parrish mentioned, operate under high standards. And I would just say, as a citizen of Oregon, that there is no financial impact study associated with this. It is expansion of gambling. If it's not studied, I think the state would have to take a look at how that's going to negatively impact revenue that comes from others' gambling revenues that are directed back to fund good causes. And specifically, the Oregon Lottery funds 1% transfers 1% of their profits to fund problem gambling treatment. And if the revenues from the lottery fall and that percent falls and there's expansion of gambling in another area, that's something that should at least be considered at some point if this were to move forward. Are there questions?
Representative Kinnemer.
Would it be accurate to say that the Oregon Lottery was created substantially in part to eliminate some very significant problems that were caused by gray games and the use of slot machines throughout the state?
Chair Holvey, Representative Kinnemer. When the lottery was first voted in by the people, and I will point out that it was voted in by the people, it was to give people fair legal access to games they wanted to play. and the money was also directed to economic development at the time. When the state legislature in 1993 looked at the gray machine poker market, there was the reason that they asked the Oregon Lottery to regulate those games is they said these gray games are legal. We are going to bring in oversight to offer a legal product that's fair, that the state's regulating it. We know that people are getting paid, and that's when the issue of problem gambling came up and the revenues were directed to help fund treatment. So yes, it was a very thoughtful process that was gone through by the state.
Mr. Chair, second question, please.
Follow up.
And on a different topic, you're asking in your testimony for an age restriction, but I believe all of these facilities have alcohol service license. Oh, excuse me, I'm wrong. Apparently, I thought they all had alcohol service licenses and would therefore be limited to 21. So I guess an age restriction is necessary. My misunderstanding. Could you clarify that for me?
Chair Hulvey, Representative Kenner, I actually don't know specifically the answer to that. However, if it is not specifically said that people under 18 can't engage in poker, that's the issue that we would bring forward,
yes.
Whether or not
Thank
they
you.
Can come in the establishment.
Thank you. Other questions? Not seeing any other questions. Thank you very much for your testimony and really the specifics of your testimony as well. It's very helpful.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask Mr. Sugarman that question, or could that question be asked of someone? Because I thought there was a liquor license.
Mr. Sugarman, would you like to come up?
And I'm sorry, I know we're taking a lot of time here, but
it's an important issue.
I think it is, because I thought the age restriction was there, and I'd like to know.
Representative Kinnemer, follow up. And yeah. Jeff, if you'd reintroduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Jeff Sugarman, representing the Encore Poker Club. Chair Hulvey, Representative Kinnemer. There are definitely clubs that do not have liquor licenses and do not serve alcohol at all. Of course, any of those places that do will not allow anyone else who's not in. I also believe that most of the other facilities that I've played in would not allow somebody who is under 18 to play. But if we were to, we would be happy to have that kind of restriction here. There's no problem with us on that.
Yeah. And would you choose 18 or 21?
I think probably 18 would be the place where we would start. Certainly open for discussion. I think we'd be happy to talk about that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate that. Is a good topic that deserves a little bit of time and some consideration, certainly. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House. Or is there anybody else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2548 at this point in time? Not seeing any. With that, I'll close public hearing on House Bill 2548. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2481.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure establishes a $50 fee to appeal the Board of Stewards ruling to the Oregon Racing Commission, and it directs the commission to refund the fee under specified circumstances. It allows the commission to require the appellant to pay the costs that are incurred by the state as a result of the appeal if the appellant withdraws the appeal within 20 days of a scheduled hearing. And it requires the administrative law judge to award to the commission the costs and attorney fees if the appellant fails without good cause to appear. There are no amendments before you.
Thank you. With that, we have Jack McGrail, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Hulvey, members of the committee. My name is Jack McGrail. I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Racing Commission, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning. I provided a brief letter, which describes the legislation. In addition to that information, I think it is important to note that any money saved from this initiative will provide increased funding for the fair meets, backside facilities, and purses. So it all goes back to help sustain and support the industry here in Oregon. And I think it's also notable that the OHBPA, which is the Oregon Horsemen's Benevolent Protection Association, which represents the horsemen in the state, does not oppose this measure. They are hundreds and perhaps thousands of owners and trainers and are the folks most impacted by the legislation. And I want to be clear that we're not trying to impose any impediment to the process to an appeal. If a licensee wants to appeal, we've got protections in place that would allow that, and only under very egregious circumstances would they forfeit that $50 appeal bond or fee.
Thank you. That concludes your testimony?
Yes, sir.
Are there questions? Representative Hurd, as I'm trying to remember everyone's name. Thank you. If I make a mistake, correct me.
No worries. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So where is it stated in the bill that this is a locked number at $50, and if there is the ability to increase it, who has that authority?
Chairman Holby, Representative Hurd, if you look at paragraph 5, let's see, it's in there. The portion of paragraph 5, third line down, it recites this, the filing fee of $50.
But is it locked in? I see $50, but how is it locked in?
Representative Hurd, I don't believe we could change that fee without changing the statute. So in terms of locking it in, the commission doesn't have any authority to alter what is in law by rule or otherwise.
Mr. Chair, so since I'm a rookie, does that mean it has to come before this body again to be increased?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, if the fee is established in the statute and it spells it out, it does probably have to come back to the legislature generally, unless they have authority in statute to change that fee.
Okay.
Which doesn't appear from the Racing Commission's point of view that they do have that authority.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions about this bill? I mean, maybe I wasn't listening close enough, but the purpose of this fee is to cover the cost of the appeal process?
Chair Holby, the purpose is to deter a licensee from filing what we would deem a wholly frivolous appeal. The cost of that appeal, if it had any merit at all, would be borne by the commission. This is really to prevent those appeals, and then they're basically no-show appeals. We've had 11 of the last 20 appeals where we've had counsel there, we've had our investigators there, our witnesses there, the ALJ there, which is the cost borne by the commission, and the appellant just doesn't show up. And
So how do you cover those costs?
We pay it out of our operating funds, Chair.
When they show up, how do you pay those costs?
When the
appellant actually shows up for the appeal, how are those costs covered?
We pay the cost. The commission shareholder pays those costs. That's part of the cost of doing business. We understand that. Whether it costs us $3,000 or $3,500 on an appeal of a fine that's $100, that's just the cost of doing business.
I was just trying to get at where your revenue comes from for this.
Oh, our operating funds?
Yes.
Chair Holby, our operating funds come from a variety of sources, mainly the license fees that we collect from the advanced deposit wagering companies. That represents the bulk of our operating funds. And we are self-funding. We don't take any money from the state. We also collect fines, which also go to our operating budget.
Okay, great. Any other questions?
I have a question.
Oh, Representative Barton.
I'm sorry, Mr. Holby. Sir, I have a really easy question. I want you to pretend I don't know anything at all about racing. The bill itself makes sense in terms of what you're trying to do. I have no issue. Can you explain to me, like, what kinds of rulings that are being appealed? Like, what does the Board of Stewards actually do at a race that in such that people would then appeal it to the full Racing Commission, then not show up?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barton, I'm happy to. I love talking about racing, so I will give you a fairly an easy example. Is a trainer who you're required to, if you're going to change equipment on a horse that's going to run in a race, you're required to report that to the Board of Stewards, and then that information is transmitted to the bettors in the racing form. Mm-hmm. So blinkers, for instance, sometimes can go on a horse or focuses the horse and makes him less distracted when they run. Mm-hmm. If you put blinkers on a horse and do not report it, you'll be fined. There'll be a steward's hearing, and typically if you're found that you've offended, you will be given a $100 fine. Right now, anyone who is fined, and it's the trainer who is fined, can appeal that. That appeal then goes through the whole process of our ALJ and hearing, and those are the types of offenses that the stewards deal with. They also deal with more serious ones regarding members of the backside who might be using drugs or something along those lines. Those are also, the Board of Stewards is the first level of hearing or adjudication.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm so adept at horse racing. What's a blinker?
Sure, something you don't use on your car.
Like, yeah, blinker, huh?
You're going to make a right turn. Which direction you're turning.
You're like flashing lights.
Yeah, blinker is a device that you put on the horse that will not allow them to see. Horses have very broad peripheral vision.
Yeah, those things on the side?
Yes, sir.
And okay,
they,
got it.
It allows them to see basically down the track, but not to focus on the grandstand or other horses they might be interested in.
Yeah.
So not signaling a left turn.
Yeah. No.
Or moving out to pass.
Yeah.
They can't signal either way.
Anyway, I
just keep their left blinker on the whole time.
Hard to avoid that one.
Chair Holt, Representative Barreto.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you. Chair Holt, I just have one question. Not being familiar with the Oregon Racing Commission, does this just deal with horse racing, or is this racing in general?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, this deals just with, we only regulate horse racing at this point, and I know there's the bill that will be before you today, which deals with greyhound racing. We do regulate that, but we don't have any currently in the state.
Okay.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony, and thank you for coming down and explaining it to us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2481? Not seeing anyone. I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2481 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2765.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is an order that prohibits greyhound racing or the operation of public training tracks or public kennels for greyhounds that participate in races, and there are no amendments before you.
So we're calling up some.
First, we're going to call up Stephen Kafoury. Is there Stephen? Representative Fagan, please start in. Just also, forgive me, Chair Holvey just suddenly left and didn't tell me what he wants to do. Okay, and Mr. Beckstead, will you join them if you're inclined? Thank you. Please go in any order you wish. Representative Fagan, perhaps, and remember to introduce yourself for the record, please.
Vice Chair Barton, members of the committee for the record, Shamia Fagan, State Representative for House District 51, bringing this bill on behalf of a couple of very important constituents, one named Maggie,
thank you,
also known in our house as Magaroo, Magaroo, Magaroo-roo-roo, Magaroo, Magaroo, Magaroodle-doo, and Loki, also known as the God of Mischief, or also known as Big Old Nugs. And those are my two 100-plus pound Labrador / Great Dane dogs. So bringing this bill on their behalf today, they've asked me to do that to discuss an important issue related to greyhound racing in this state. It's a very simple bill. It essentially deletes the statute that allows greyhound racing in the state of Oregon. In fact, we actually only have one dog track in the state of Oregon. It's in East Multnomah County. Has not been operational for 10 years. In fact, recently, the Portland Tribune pointed out that the mayor of Wood Village is actually looking to sell the property and encourage other development. Passing this bill would just help signal to the developers that it is indeed available for other use. Mr. Kafoury is going to talk more about greyhound racing and kind of the inhumane and cruelty of the industry itself. And just to point out that greyhound racing is presently illegal now in 39 states. And most recently, the Colorado legislature did what we are attempting to do here today, which is just to delete the statute enabling the racing after they had been unoperational for about 10 years as well. So with that, I will turn it to Mr. Kafoury.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafoury. I represent an organization called Grey 2K USA, which is a 501c3 that's dedicated to protecting greyhounds. It has a very narrow focus. They're interested in eliminating greyhound racing where it exists and in helping to protect hounds in states where it is presently existing and they are not in the process of eliminating. Since its inception in 2001, we've been instrumental in closing 28 racetracks around the country, and racing right now is against the law in 39 states. I've just passed out testimony from our executive director, Christine Gorchak, who has explains a little bit about the problems with racing. The racing in itself, although it looks great when you watch it as an outsider, it's actually quite dangerous to the animals. There are lots and lots of accidents in which animals are maimed or even killed during the race itself. There's lots of culling that goes on of animals early in the breeding process and later after the animals are no longer used as races. Our organization is involved in attempting to adopt greyhounds out to the public, but there's a huge supply of dogs, much larger than the demand, and so there is a lot of euthanasia that goes on of greyhounds. We think it's an inhumane practice, and we would like to have it stopped around the United States, and eliminating it in Oregon is one of those steps. As Representative Fagan said, we do not race here in Oregon. We have not for 10 years, so there's no problem about any loss of revenue. There's no problem about any loss of jobs. This is a bill which should have no opposition. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director and Western Regional Director for the Humane Society of the United States, here in strong support of the bill to ban greyhound racing in Oregon. Greyhound racing is a serious animal welfare concern for the Humane Society of the United States, and all you have to do to understand why is go visit the landfills in Florida, because they are full of greyhound dogs and greyhound puppies, and there are more being dumped there right now as we speak, guaranteed. It might be helpful to compare a little bit with thoroughbred racing, horse racing, and there are definitely problems with thoroughbred racing. We have far too many healthy young thoroughbreds going to slaughter every year, but the thoroughbred industry, I feel, has taken very important steps to address overbreeding and to address second careers for racers, and you just don't see the same level of commitment to animal welfare in the greyhound community. It is notoriously full of bad actors, and Mr. Kafoury said that that dogs that can't race or puppies that don't meet the bill are euthanized, and you know euthanasia means a peaceful death, and the way that these dogs are killed is unspeakable. So we strongly support this bill. Greyhound racing doesn't have a place in Oregon. The crowd that tends to frequent dog tracks is a notoriously rougher crowd than what you see at the horse tracks, and really doesn't have a place in the communities of Oregon. So we strongly support the bill and urge a yes vote. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions. Representative Doherty.
Well, the fact of the matter is we have no greyhound tracks in Oregon anymore and haven't had for 10 years. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, we have a Greyhound track in Fairview or Wood Village.
Do we have an operational Greyhound track?
We do not have. It has not been operational for 10 years. And one of the things we'd like to have with this bill is a signal to developers that this is not going to open up again. And I know that, as Representative Fagan said, the mayor of Wood Village recently had an article saying we'd like to have this developed in something else besides a racetrack.
Well, that it had a follow-up.
Yes.
It has it not been the issue of development before, the Multnomah Kennel Club?
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, the last time there was an attempt to do something, the owners wanted to set up a casino, and that went to the vote of the people and was roundly defeated.
Yeah, and also just one, it's going to be not a question but a comment. The crowd's not always that rough. I actually got tuition to go to school one evening at the Greyhound, the Multnomah Kennel Club. we were not all that rough, but we had to earn tuition. But thank you very much. But no, MLK, this has been closed for years.
No comment. Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just following on Representative Doherty, let's see, last time I went to the dog track, I think, was about 1988, and I didn't think the crowd was that rough, but I don't know.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Widener.
Just to help out Scott a little bit here, a question for you. Do you think people at horse racing are better than people at Greyhound racing tracks?
I wouldn't
I'm going to give you a chance to save yourself here.
I wouldn't even
Since,
touch that.
Not too many of us have been to horse racing, but dog racing.
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, no. Present company excluded, by all means. I actually, as a kid, went to the dog track in Colorado, and I wasn't a sketchy person back then either, but just, you know, anecdotally, you know, what you hear is that there's a greater incidence of organized crime and things like that participating in the dog tracks.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Chair Holby. A couple of things. Dangerous to animals during racing, and then euthanasia, which you say are both prevalent in horse racing too. And so my question is, by eliminating the Greyhound racing, and they've been quite successful, I guess, throughout the U.S. with 39 states not doing this, is the next step to go to eliminate horse racing also? So that seems to be kind of the trend, maybe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, that's an interesting question. As I said earlier, my organization, Grey 2K USA, is solely focused on dog racing. We are not interested in the issue of horse racing at all. And to my knowledge, I have not heard of any attempt anywhere to outlaw horse racing. Now, you know, there may be some organization somewhere that I've not heard of. I'm not saying, you know, trying to prove a negative. Just that it's no intention of any organization that I've been interested in or involved in that's interested in eliminating. You would have perhaps a better knowledge nationally.
Did you want to speak, Chris, on that?
I would just echo Mr. Kafouri's comment. That's certainly not the intent of this bill or the organization bringing forward this bill.
And Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, the Humane Society of the United States does not oppose horse racing. We encourage reform within the horse racing industry to eliminate abusive practices such as doping and excessive racing and those kind of things. But we do not, as a matter of policy, oppose horse racing as a sport.
Follow up.
Yes, and this may be a moot issue since we don't have dog racing here in Oregon, but as far as the reforms, couldn't those also be implemented on dog racing also, the same reforms that you do in horse racing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, that's exactly what we're working on as a national organization in those states that do have dog racing. We're working on more transparency, trying to get information about how many dogs are hurt, how many dogs are euthanized. We're working on those reforms as we speak in states that have dog racing. But since we don't have any dog racing here presently, it wouldn't make sense for us to be involved in reforms in Oregon.
Can I also address the question? Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, one of the things that makes greyhound racing bad from an animal welfare perspective is how the animals are treated during their racing careers. They are kept in crates except when they're racing, and the reform would have to be, you know, a top-to-bottom systemic approach, really looking at the mindset that a lot of breeders and trainers have. I also want to point out that the bill does not ban greyhounds or greyhound breeding. There are a lot of people who really love greyhounds as pets. They make wonderful pets, and so there is no effort here to address the greyhound breed. We just want to put an end to the abuse of greyhounds.
Other questions? Representative Widener.
If I could, Scott, which landfills in Florida are they filling with greyhounds?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, I'd say the ones closest to the dog track.
I don't have specifics,
but we do know that there are a lot of greyhound breeders, and Florida is really the hotbed for greyhound racing.
Sweet.
Other questions? One question for me is, I guess how we defined greyhound racing, and I know there's lots of other dog like agility tests that are actually races and things like that. So if a greyhound happens to be participating in that, I mean, is this bill narrow enough to really define, what is a greyhound race? Does it have to be all greyhounds or,
Chair Holvey, the statute, the bill deletes the part of the statute that specifically allows gambling greyhound racing. So it's not my understanding. I have a friend who does dog agility. They're not operating under that statute, so I don't believe there's any way that would actually be affected. What this bill actually does is delete statute that specifically authorizes greyhound racing. I'm not aware of any dog agility that operate under that statute.
Yeah, I was just hoping that we could avoid that, some confusion there if possible. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, the bill is very narrowly drafted, and it applies only to limiting statutes that are in the law. Now, the only new language is this sentence that says a person may not conduct a greyhound race meet in this state, and that's in the section of the statute where it talks about different kinds of animal races. So I don't think there's any problem with that.
Though I'm not totally convinced yet, I'll take that and we'll have that conversation a little further, perhaps. Is there any other questions?
Mr. Chair, if that's a concern after reading the bill again, we'd be happy to put an amendment in that says this has nothing to do with any kind of agility tests or other kinds of events where greyhounds may be participating with other breeds.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. So seeing nothing else, appreciate your testimony and bringing the issue forward. So is there anyone else that wanted to testify? Oh, David Ellsburn. Excuse me.
Thank you, Chair Holden and members of the committee. As you know already, I represent Voices of Problem Gambling Recovery. And I just wanted on record that our organization is in favor of this bill. For me, it's a quality of life issue. When I came here in 1980, I loved Oregon. I loved New Mexico, but I loved Oregon even more. And at that time, there was horse racing and maybe a little bit of charitable gambling and social gaming. But then Mega Bucks came along and Indian casinos. And year by year, we've added more and more gambling. Scratch-offs, sports action, which was eventually killed by the NCAA, video poker, line games, otherwise known as slot machines that the Oregon Lottery operates, keno, raffles, and then there was a failed attempt to bring gambling onto the Internet by the Oregon Lottery. I don't like where this trajectory is going. Our organization is not fundamentally... We don't take a position on gambling or against it, but Personally, I'm against the expansion of gambling. I think we have enough gambling in Oregon. I don't want to see us become like Las Vegas. And similarly, I don't think we need to expand poker clubs either. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you.
No questions? Now, is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2765? Not seeing one, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2765. And I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2116.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure extends the sunset for tax credit for the expenses for household and dependent care services that are necessary for gainful employment. There are no amendments before you, and there is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Thank you. And can we have Chris Olenek come up? And committee, the purpose of this bill, I'm going to have Chris Olenek kind of lay out what the purpose of our committee is in regards to looking at tax credits, and just to give a general overview. If we are going to have this bill further discussed in this committee, we will have another public hearing to get it actually down into the weeds a little bit more. There is a potential that we will move this bill actually without considering it to another committee where it has another kind of, I guess, a partner bill that should be considered together. And so I'm working with the Speaker's office to see if they may desire to move this bill to another committee for consideration. But there is a likelihood we will get another bill to look at as far as tax credits, and you'll get to listen to Mr. Olenek describe what the purpose of us doing that is. So with that, thank you for being here, Chris. If you could introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Olenek, Legislative Revenue Office. And for some context, in 2009, the legislature placed sunset dates on virtually every income, personal and corporate income tax credit, and put them on a six-year rotating cycle so that they were divided into three groups so that every 2 years, one-third of the tax credits would be reviewed. The idea was a policy review to evaluate whether or not the tax credits were doing what they were intended to do and whether or not they were efficient. And then in 2013, so we had the first group in 2011, the second group in 2013, and this is the third group. So after this session, all of the tax credits will have received at least one kind of review through the legislative process. What is new this session is a result of House Bill 2002 from 2013 that requires our office, the Legislative Revenue Office, to produce a report on the tax credits that are sunsetting in that biennium. So that we released a report to the House and Senate Revenue Committees on the 18 tax credits that are sunsetting at the end of this year. And that report is available on our publication page. It's also in OLIS. And there's an excerpt from that report that is in your part of your committee materials today. That report takes the 18 credits and puts them into five policy chapters, if you will. And one of those chapters is child care. And so within the child care chapter, if you will, there are four tax credits. There is the child and dependent care credit, which is the one in House Bill 2116. There is a working family child care credit. There is an employer-provided child care credit, and a contributions to the Office of Child Care tax credit. From kind of an economic standpoint, those four credits, two of them are consumer-based credits, one of them is an employer-based credit, and one of them is, for lack of a better term, a regulation credit, because it is tied with the funding of a state agency. So the credit that you have before you is one of the two consumer tax credits. The other consumer tax, all three of the other child care tax credits are in the Human Services and Housing Committee. And those are scheduled for public hearing this afternoon. So they have the one consumer, the employer one, and then the regulation one. So the policy question that the chair was referring to was whether or not this consumer credit should go to the other committee so that both of the consumer credits can be reviewed side by side and then have that employer-based tax credit sent over to this committee because it is available to employers as opposed to the consumers of child care. So that's and just, I guess, briefly, in the materials that you have there, the excerpts from the report, there was an Appendix D which contains some policy questions which are meant to be guidelines to help committees discuss the policy analysis and go through that to come to their conclusions as to whether or not a given tax credit should be modified in any way, should be allowed to sunset, or should be extended. And they can run the gamut. It can be a simple 6-year extension without any policy modifications. It can be allowed to sunset, or any kind of modifications made can be done. That's the directive we've gotten from legislative leadership in terms of how this process is supposed to unfold. So at the beginning of that, I kind of reworked the document. That's the Appendix D. Those are those questions. And the rest of that handout is this child care chapter, which starts off with an introduction and talks about some direct spending programs and the tax credits. Part of the requirement of the bill was to draw some kind of link between these indirect spending of tax credits and the direct spending of the Ways and Means process. And then each of the credits are discussed individually. There's an attempt at a policy purpose. And that's really a key question for evaluating any tax credit, is to understand what it is supposed to do. What does the legislature want to achieve by enacting a tax credit? So what I did there for each of the credits was I went back to the implementing legislation and tried to glean some sort of policy purpose. Because generally speaking, statute does not specifically say why this tax credit is in law. On the one hand, it seems kind of obvious, but there can be some other nuanced questions in there. And so there's that section on policy purpose. So any refinement, part of this process is to get as much refinement and as much clarity as possible from the policy committees about why these tax credits should exist. The document that goes on to describe what the credit is, the history of the revenue impact, so what it's cost for the general fund, and then there is a policy analysis section that talks about all 4 tax credits collectively. It probably raises more questions than answers, but it's an attempt to move the discussion forward about the things to consider as to why or why not the tax credit should be in place and what their structure should be.
Thank you. And committee, I think it's important that we understand this process and really what the purpose of a policy committee looking at tax credits can be. But I wanted to call this to your attention so that you, if you choose to start delving into this specific tax credit, I just wanted to warn you that this tax credit may be referred to another committee to examine. And so I didn't want you to, you know, spend a lot of time looking at this tax credit if we were actually not going to end up considering it. Yeah. And but I think it is important for us to understand this process. And if this bill does stay in our committee, Mr. Alanak will be coming back to go over the specific child care aspects of this tax credit. But there's a strong possibility we'll have another bill that is relating to tax credits. So I just wanted to give that kind of overview. Even if we don't end up reviewing it, I think it's important for us to understand the process of the policy committee roles in reviewing tax credits and then sending it on. It is an important aspect of what the legislature should be doing. So with that, does anybody have any specific questions about the process? Representative Barreto.
Yeah, Chair Olby, maybe, thank you, maybe not the process, but when the revenue committee looks at a tax credit versus a write-off in your taxes, do they view that differently? I mean, as far as if it's the person's money or if it's the government's money, is that different between a write-off and a tax credit?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Burrito, by write-off, are you referring to deductions and so forth?
Sure, deductions in your tax form.
All of these fall into the category of what are called tax expenditures. and tax expenditures, and there is a tax expenditure report, but it accompanies the governor's budget. It's a very thick document. It lists about 352 items. And there will be disagreement about whether given items in that report are tax expenditures or not, because a tax expenditure is basically an exception to a normative tax base, what the normal tax base is. And there will be disagreement about what the normal tax base is. Items, now when you're using the term write-off, generally the first thing that comes to my mind are business expenses, cost of doing business. Those are not considered tax expenditures. So those wouldn't be in that report per se, because those are considered part of the normal tax base. But there are plenty of, they're called exclusions or deductions that are in that report. In recent sessions, the committee has focused on tax credits, and part of the reason for that, there are several of them. Tax credits are in specific to Oregon law. There are several deductions and exclusions that affect the Oregon tax, but it's due to our connection to the federal tax law. And without getting too much into the weeds of tax law, at least as a starting point, and we'll see how things progress over time with the legislative body, the focus has been on the tax credits. These are provisions in Oregon statute, and they are also more valuable in a dollar-for-dollar sense than write-offs or deductions. Broadly speaking, using very round math, a $1,000 deduction at a 10% tax rate is equivalent to a $100 tax credit. There's been some confusion about that. So again, focusing on the credits. And it comes back to this 2009 legislation that put these sunset dates. Because if the legislature doesn't take action on these 18 tax credits, they sunset, they go away. And, well, I'll just leave it at that. And so there was a cost to extending the tax credit.
Right.
It's all part of the current revenue forecast. And so my latest estimate for the cost of simply extending the tax credits 6 years is about $64 million for this biennium. And the revenue committees have been given a budget of about $14 million for all of the tax credits. And so part of the work that the revenue committees are doing is to look for other ways to raise some revenue to pay for the extension of tax credits. So what they're really looking for from the policy committees are hoping for is as much clarity as possible around the policies that the policy committees would like within the tax credits, and then perhaps even a gradation of which are the more, some sort of prioritization among the tax credits. And in some committees, they'll have multiple tax credits, so they could prioritize them by credit. If a committee has one tax credit, there can still be a couple versions of a policy that might be more or less expensive. And I feel like I'm rambling, so I'm not sure.
That's fine. We can visit later about it, too.
And I guess one thing I would add that is that's different this time around is in conjunction with this report, the Legislative Revenue Office was given another staff, an FTE, so that we could be available to the policy committees during the session. So for good or bad, I'm that person. I'll let you decide if that's good.
Well, we'll leave that one unanswered for now. But just a quick question, just a point of interest, I guess, more than anything else. Doesn't have much to do with the particular tax credit. But so our revenue forecast assumes that these tax credits are not sunsetting and are going to be continued, or was it the opposite?
It's, Mr. Chair, it's the opposite. The Oregon forecast is very specific. It has to be for current law. The state economist, when he makes that forecast, and the next forecast will be released on the 19th, they can't assume that the legislature is going to do anything one way or the other, so they have to go by current law. So embedded in that forecast is all of these 18 credits sunset at the end of this year. And so that's why to extend the tax credits, it actually costs money. So for, I guess sticking with the bill that's in front of you right now, I think the cost is $9 million a year. And so that sunset, part of the revenue forecast has a cost for 2015 of $9 million, but then from some perspective, a gain in revenue of $9 million for the second half of the biennium. So to extend the tax credit, that's spending that $9 million.
Interesting. It's so what's
kind
the
of an inverse.
What's the total cost, or what's the total amount of revenue for all 18 tax credits that aren't considered in the revenue forecast?
To extend them all, $64 million.
Okay.
To not to if all of the policy, if the legislature decides to extend the tax credits without modifying the policies in any way, my most recent estimate is $64 million.
And I have one more follow-up on that. Okay. So how does that impact the kicker?
Great question.
At least let's make it simple.
That's a great question, Mr. Chair.
Ask simple questions.
Yeah, great. That's good.
Okay. And our quality of life, please.
The kicker, and I'm...
Can we adjust the kicker based on whether these get to passed or not? I mean, I guess that's the question. Will this,
okay,
whether these whether these 18 tax credits pass, will that impact
whether
the kicker kicks?
My clarifying question was, are you referring to the potential kicker that's being discussed now or the next biennium? And I assume it's the one that's you're going to hear about next week.
Correct.
In many respects, it's too late to modify these policies to affect the kicker.
Okay.
Now, to get into kicker policy, back in May of 2013, there was the close of session forecast. Well, there was the May forecast. And so then the kicker is based off the close of session forecast, which is that May forecast plus any legislative revenue changes or legislative changes. So those legislative changes can include changes to the credit policy. So tax credits affect that starting point for the kicker at the beginning of the biennium. So in terms of how the tax credits affect the current kicker, that was kind of set into place back in May. Now, the use of the tax credits over the 2 years can affect the kicker. If the tax credits are not used as much as we think they're going to be used, then that will be more revenue coming into the system and then push us toward a kicker or over. If tax credits get used more than we thought they were going to be used, that actually mitigates the kicker. It's kind of an inverse relationship, which is why it's a little odd.
Right, and as I wrap this up, I'm going to let somebody else ask a question.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Holby.
Because this really goes against my grain is keeping germane to the bill.
But typically a tax credit though is the purpose of it is to improve the economy, to spur on the movement of dollars to bring in more tax dollars to cover the cost of the kicker or to cover the cost of the tax credit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burrito, there are those kinds of credits. Yes, and in terms of the body, in 2009, when all of the tax credits, and at the time there were about 64 of them, they were placed into three bins, three very, very loosely related policies. And one of those groups was trying to get all of the business investment decisions into that group. So all of those would be reviewed at the same time. So in front of the legislature would be this menu of business investment tax credits to be evaluated. For the most part, this group are, I'm not sure what the best language would be, the personal related. There's some disability tax credits, sure, which aren't an incentive to do anything. But to your point, there are two tax credits related to business investment. There is a business investment tax credit, and then there's one for dealing with the university research.
Follow up. However, these tax credits here would not need to, I mean, looking at that, if dollars go into the system and through administration come back at less, these tax credits here would not need to go into the administration. They would be more efficient in taking care of the situation here than having to go through the system and then coming back to help out that particular interest. I mean, any time tax dollars go into the government and then they come back to help a certain situation, you know, some of it gets used up in through administrative costs.
To that point, that's one of the arguments for using a tax credit
that's
as
correct.
Opposed to a direct spending. If you want child care, We have the state has direct spending programs for child care, and they have the child care credits. One of the arguments for the credits is that kind of efficiency argument where just let the people keep their money, they'll spend it on their daycare, and the state doesn't have to get involved. There is that argument, yes.
Representative Widener, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to keep it germane to 2116, but also the broader picture. I guess 2116, what does it do as far as economic development or job creation for the state of Oregon? And do they have you going through each tax credit and looking at it, what it does to incentivize growth versus reduction in the economy?
Chair Holby, Representative Widener, the argument for this is a consumer credit, so it's the parent or the guardian. And one of the reasons for having those kinds of consumer-based child care credits is that it enables these people, these parents, to get to work. So it's not a business investment per se. You could argue it's a human capital investment by allowing these people to stay employed if they're right on the fringe where, you know, if I go to work, all of my money goes to child care, and so there's no point in me going to work. So the cost of child care, another way of saying that is the cost of child care is a barrier to entry into the labor force. And so the tax credits reduce the cost of child care. They reduce that cost of entering the workforce or re-entering or staying in the workforce.
I may follow up.
Yeah, one more. Yeah,
I'm going to stay germane. So on 2116 with the child care cost, most of the people that would be at that income level, though, probably wouldn't even need the tax credit per se because they wouldn't be paying enough in taxes just because of their income level. Would that be fair to say?
I think that's a fair question to ask, and that would be one of the resources is for me to, as to the committee would be to get as much information as possible to help review those questions.
And as I stated at the beginning, we weren't going to try to get too far down the weeds down this particular tax credit right now. And if we do end up considering the tax credit, we will get down in the weeds on that a little bit. So I just kind of wanted to give the committee an overview of of the purpose of this kind of a bill when they come back and want the policy committees to review a particular sunset. And so I was going to kind of wrap that up at this point. I don't know if Mr. Mullen still wants to testify on this particular tax credit. Okay, thank you. With that, committee, I'm going to close the...
Oh, yes, he wants to.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
He said no.
Oh.
I thought you did.
Maybe it's wishful thinking.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee for the Law Center, and I'm also the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition Tax and Revenue Committee, and I don't often appear at this committee. I think the idea of perhaps sending this particular tax credit to the House Human Services and Housing Committee makes sense. I will be testifying at that committee this afternoon to talk about the tax credits that are up. And just I can't pass up the opportunity to give a real compliment to Chris Alanek for the great work that he does. We were all delighted to see him be named as the person to do the tax credit work. So I'll just leave it at that. If it is the order of business for this committee to work on this particular tax credit, I hope to be back to talk about the content.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2116. And Jan, do we have any introduction of committee measures today?
No.
We do not. Anything else? Good of the order for anybody? I just want to make a comment. I want to thank the committee for our first week. We got done and addressed most all issues. I do want to point out that this is a very large committee. 11 people on this committee. I think it's the largest policy committee that we have in the legislature. And as such, it's really, you know, one of my goals is to get through the agendas. And so I don't mean to appear like I'm trying to shut the conversation off. I don't want to do that. But I do want to make sure our conversations sort of remain on topic and to the bill itself that we're looking at. And that you do try to remember that The dialogue through the chair is important. As if we side conversations that happen, it does slow down the process quite a bit and will make it more difficult for us to get through our agendas. So I appreciate your consideration when you're asking questions to you know, try to keep them concise and try to keep them germane to the bill that we're looking at, and so we can get our work done, because I think that's really important that we do give fair consideration to everything. Having said that, I'm still try to provide as much conversation as we can. Representative Esquivel.
Mr. Chair, do we not have the second most bills in the building for a committee? We usually do behind judiciary.
I don't believe that's quite true. I mean, historically, this committee has had a large amount of bills. I think a revenue committee is, you know, just sheer, due to the sheer amount of introduction of revenue bills is up there. I think we're in the running at the top end of the scale generally. That remains to be seen as the bill referrals come out. I don't know what the subject matter of all the rest of the bills that we still haven't been referred yet are. So I appreciate everybody's attention to that, and I think Vice Chair Kinnemer made a good point. You know, it's, and even I, you know, sometimes don't get a chance to really thoroughly read all these bills, but it is important if you're going to focus on reading bills to focus on reading the bills that are in your, in the committees that you serve on. That's really critical to us, you know, having a good discussion on policy. So I encourage everybody to read the bills ahead of the committee meeting, and any questions you may be able to answer offline is also important, and sometimes you may be able to follow up with people after the committee if you don't get a chance to get your question answered to your satisfaction. So with that, I appreciate your consideration on this issue, and look forward. We have a big agenda on Monday that's going to have a lot of questions, a lot of, perhaps a little bit of opposing views. And I think we also have a gun rally, which, if you haven't experienced, will be a little bit different for some on Monday as well. So we'll look forward to seeing you. Unfortunately, we will be starting at 8 a.m. on Monday, not 8:30.
The ninth.
Mr. Chair.
It's next Monday. This coming Monday is a gun rally. And committee members, we sent a note to your office as a reminder there's an unusual evening meeting for this committee on Monday the 16th, and that's a joint meeting with the Senate Workforce Committee.
Correct, okay. And that's over the paid sick leave. We'll be hearing public testimony in the evening on that right. Monday. So hopefully you can make it to that as well. Nothing else. I appreciate that, and I will adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.